Welcome to DivCasts from the University of Chicago Divinity School. For more of our podcasts and information about our terms of use, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts.
He conducts ethnographic and historical research on Afro-Caribbean cultures with an emphasis on Afro-Cuban religious formations and their relations to the histories and cultures of the wider Atlantic. So, over lunch, let's hear about how not to cook history. Thank you, Professor Javier.
Well, thank you, Karen. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks to you all for coming. Title, of course, fits well with a lunch talk, I guess, of history. We can see many cooks involved in the same kind of, it happens to be polenta, but it could also be amala con quimbombo that they might be making if we were to transpose that to Cuba. But anyway, let me tell you a little bit. I'll probably take about 20 minutes or so, but if you want to stop me at any point, Karen, just, because I can probably ramble on for the entire period. So let me tell you a little bit about, first about, where I'm coming from. As you may have noticed from my accent, I'm German. That gives me a little bit of an advantage in undergraduate lecture courses because I can tell my students that Franz Boas, the founder of the discipline here, probably sounded somewhat like me. Now I started studying Afro-Cuban religion, for lack of a better term, and then I'll explain a little bit what my misgivings with all these, both Afro-Cuban and religion, these three terms are. But I started doing that kind of thing around 1984-85, when I originally was planning, hoping to get a chance to do field work in Cuba, which, as the reviewers of my proposal, I think rightly claimed, would not have been feasible at the time. So I set out to the next best solution, namely doing research in Miami. And I wrote my dissertation partly, it's part an attempt to sort of come up with the idea, or come up with a kind of historical sociology of the transmission of cultural practices and forms of knowledge across the Atlantic and then in the Americas, basically from Africa to Cuba. Although I think that already in that book I was very strongly disinclined to view anything that I was seeing in Cuba, in Miami in this case, as a remnant of anything. And, one of the anecdotes which I start out with in this book is one of those horribly, never-ending traffic jams on, I think, Route 836, leading from the airport towards Miami Beach, where I was stuck with somebody who became a good friend over the past, almost 30 years now. A man named Ernesto Pichardo, who some of you may know, won the 1993 Supreme Court case legalizing animal sacrifice for practitioners of his church of the Mukum Baba Nueli. So anyway, so here we are, stuck in horrible traffic, 95 degrees heat. Ernesto was at that point driving a red Corvette with broken down AC and the windows, power windows didn't work either. So he was sitting there just drenched in sweat. And I said to him, Ernesto, why do you have to drive this fucking car? He says to me, but don't you understand? A good diviner, and he is an Oriadea, the Taurishal diviner. He said, a I don't understand. A good diviner has to drive a good car. And so, as I went on to write my second book called Wizards and Scientists, Explorations in Afro-Cuban Modernity and Tradition, and the framing was deliberate, that Duke University Press actually got back to me and said, writing, "Oh, surely you mean tradition and modernity." And I said, "No, that's not what I mean. What I mean is that what we today understand as Afro-Cuban, or if we generalize that perhaps even further in the Atlantic world, what we understand as traditions are actually coextensive and have the same kind of origin as what we today understand as Western rational modernity. Both emerge out of violent processes of modernization, which I think the argument can be made, Eric Williams and C.L.R. James made it long ago, that actually commenced in the Caribbean region, particularly in the agro-industrial complexes known as slave labor-driven agro-industrial complexes known as sugar plantations, emerged there way earlier than in the metropole itself. You would be hard-pressed to find anything, let's say around 1670, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a kind of proto-industrial, certainly heavily capitalized, high-tech work site employing more than 200 workers at a time. This in Europe was still unthinkable, but it was had been happening in the Caribbean since the 1560s, perhaps. So out of this, argues C.L.R. James, or in this context, what enslaved Africans and their descendants underwent was a violent process of modernization, not just in that kind of political, economic, and technological sense, but also in the sense of being completely individualized. That is, being separated from all that had constituted their past, all that had constituted their prior social lives, and all that, what we would call culture that people normally take for granted when they live in it, so to speak, and practice it. So, I was arguing in that in Wizards and Scientists that what we call Afro-Cuban religion is actually a product of modernity just as much as thermodynamics as modern as if you look towards, for example, Horkheimer and Adorno's Dialectics of Enlightenment, as modern really as the kind of identity, as they put it, of domination and reason. So it's a kind of perhaps contrapuntal relationship. I wouldn't necessarily want to insist on that. Perhaps it's also a dialectic of sorts. But these things keep evolving in tandem, and not only because want to see Afro-Cuban tradition as something very modern, but also because whoever practices Afro-Cuban tradition, so to speak, has never had a chance to do it, without having to confront, persecutorial regimes that varied in terms of, their justification for why this had to be eradicated, but they always were conducted with the mirage of, kind of a civilizing project, a kind of modernization project, whether in the capitalist or in the socialist sense, as in Cuba, where it took the revolutionary government 40 years almost, before they conceded that their project of folklorization of these traditions as kind of a legacy of capitalist past that had been overcome in a classless and raceless society, you know, we're just simply not melting away under the sun of socialism, but we're, you know, sort of flourishing in its shadow, so to speak. But anyway, so that's yet another aspect. You know, and then finally, you know, a few years ago, I thought about, you know, the Wizards and Scientists book is in many ways, and I don't know, you know, obviously, I can't imagine that you've read it, but it's in many ways a very tragic and serious book. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm also in that book as a kind of as a persona, so to speak, but in a different way than I wanted to write myself into this book, maybe in a very ironic style. And what this kind of is an attempt to, or what the current book started out was an attempt to kind of clarify to myself what exactly I had actually been doing for the past 25 years. And it took its origins I was the president of the Society for the Anthropology of Religion between 2007 and 2009, I think. And you always have to sort of, towards the end of it, you have to give a presidential lecture. And I called it BL2532S3, How Not to Study Afro in quotation marks, Cuban in quotation marks, and Religion in quotation marks. And then I added, you know, it was held in a conference facility in Northern California, Asilomar near Monterey. And there were signs all over the place, you know, what to do if you encounter a mountain lion. Scare it down, you know. I was surprised at, that recommendation. So I gave that lecture the subtitle, you know, it's gone from the book now, but I gave it the subtitle, A Casual Attempt at Staring Down Mountain Lions. The mountain lions that I was sort of confronted with, in the book I call them dragons, that, basically have the function of shielding certain things from us by looking very fierce and very difficult to overcome. And, what those dragons are, one of them, for example, is the simple notion that these are pre-modern remnants in a modern society, social context. You know, sort of that's something that's taken for granted. So with all the kind of especially in my discipline background of studying Africanity in outside of the continent as something that has been left over, that has survived, that is a remnant, or I think in setting up, however well-intentioned my intellectual precursors, particularly, of course, Melville Herskovitz, your colleague's historian of religion named Jacob Dorman called the white whale of the Black Atlantic, has set up a kind of an agenda where it's ultimately anthropologists who have to authenticate what is or isn't African about things that people practice outside the continent. And you could actually also and I have done that in the introduction to a collection of essays called Africas of the Americas. You can actually extend that to Africa as well and say, what exactly is it that makes things on the continent African? I mean, to just give you one of my favorite examples, what, for example, is going on when Episcopalians, distraught over the ordination of gay priests, break away from the Anglican congregation and become affiliated with an African province that has a suitably homophobic agenda. Nigeria, Uganda. There's lots of congregations in places like Virginia or elsewhere who practice a form of Anglicanism that is African-directed and African-derived. So are these people then practicing an African religion? I think it's a very interesting question. So so here we go with the Afro. In my case, of course, you know, documentably, David Brown has, you know, sort of researched that, you know, very meticulously. Since the earliest years of the 20th century, let me start all over again. I mean, the cult of Ifa, if you're familiar with that, you know, it's ultimately a Yoruba-derived divination system that emerged in Cuba probably in the second half of the 19th century. Cuba imported slaves until very late, and actually started importing slaves very late, namely in the 1790s. Prior to that, slavery was a fairly marginal institution until Spain finally threw Cuba open to sort of free trade, and thereby sort of got its sugar industry to take off in a vertiginous manner. And so large scale slave imports from Africa coincided with almost a century of warfare between different Yoruba-speaking groups in the Bight of Benin, what today is Nigeria, of course. So you look at a large number of Yoruba speakers in or speakers of related languages that we nowadays understand as Yoruba come together mainly Western Cuba, actually, and also particularly urban settings like Havana. And by the late 19th century, you get a surprisingly small number of people, namely five elderly Africans, who get together in the town of Regla, which is sort of a kind of an industrial municipality on the eastern side of the Bay of Havana, which is actually also where I do my field work. And they get together to codify the mechanism whereby the priesthood of Ifa, and thereby, of course, the entire cosmology and spirit world that comes with it, gets reproduced and transmitted over time. And what they do is they set up a mechanism whereby it's the gods themselves who actually choose who needs to be initiated. And they do so, for example, by visiting you with illness or terrible accidents or other misfortunes. And then you go to a divine and they'll tell you what you have to initiate. Well, what that leads to is that now I'm back where I started from, already by the in the early years of the 20th century, you get the first white priest of this particular oracle. And it's a man who, of Spanish origin, bodeguero, in whose back room, these elderly Africans have, been doing their business. And so he actually nowadays constitutes one of the five, the founder of one of the five major initiatory lines in Ifa, worldwide, And even earlier, I've worked on several. Afro-Cuban traditions, there are about four of them, and maybe a new one that's actually emerging right in front of our eyes these days. But in the case of a male esoteric sodality known as Abakwa, we can actually document that the branch, which is nowadays regarded as the most phenotypically black one, and possibly in terms of its prestige, the most African one, actually descends from a group of 13 white people who were initiated into that society in 1857. So this is very, very early on. So here we get a kind of a problem right away with a necessary question about what is African or what is Cuban about this. But we also get a problem because given, the 20th century history of that island, after 1959, the massive exodus of from revolutionary Cuba spread these forms of ritual practice across the globe, not just the Americas, but practically everywhere. I mean, there are, Europe is full of little casas de santo, Afro-Cuban cult groups. I spent the last year on a fellowship at the Swedish Collegium for Advanced Studies, and lo and behold, towards the end of my stay, I discovered that there's a group of practitioners of Afro-Cuban religion right there in Uppsala. You know, most of them Swedes, of course, as one would suspect. Some people have already sort of gone around and said that I never really understand how people can come up with these numbers. So people will always write, oh, there are so and so many thousands or millions of practitioners of of Santeria or Lukumi religion or whatever people are calling it these days. And how they can possibly count them is something that is completely beyond me. I mean, you can certainly go around in Havana and see, when you see somebody dressed all in white with lots of ritual necklaces around their neck, then you can be pretty sure that it's a recent initiate, Iaho. But until 1991, nobody dared to wear his or her ritual necklaces in public. But now you see them, and the intellectuals, some local politicians, wear them, and it's no longer, of course, incompatible with socialism, which is in itself an interesting data. But I received those necklaces as well. Does that make me a santero? Well, I think not. On the other hand, however, and that's another thing that I'm looking at in the book, when I started doing this research in the mid-1980s, there were five people here in the United States doing similar things. And as it turned out, all of them, except me, are nowadays practicing santeros. So the constellation of scholar and practitioner has really, in a sense, begun to shift. And here's but on the other side as well. This here is a book written by a friend of mine, a man who calls himself on the label Oba Oriate Miguel Billy Ramos Hilari Oba, which these are his ritual titles. He's also an Oba Oriate, a cowrie shell divine. But he's also a PhD candidate in history at Florida International University. So, the book is kind of an interesting generic hybrid, because it's both kind of a divination manual and a historiography of, coconut divination in this case, fully annotated with footnotes, with archival work that went into it, but also oral history, and I suspect a little bit of divination as well. And that wouldn't be surprising at all, because people have been divining the history of their practices for probably 60 to 80 years now, and that Supreme Court case too. As I learned, when I was, watching this from afar, and occasionally either telephoning or writing the charter, that was in the days before the internet, of course. I suddenly figured out that he had the whole court strategy, planned out and was monitoring it, as it was going on, through divination. So, why not? Evans Pritchard, when he was in 1930s, 20s, Sunderland, of course, as you may know, famously wrote that, organizing his life in accordance with the poison oracle was, worked perfectly fine. He probably couldn't have done it when he went back to Oxford, the killing filling the chickens or poisoning the chickens would have been a little problematic there, but just to say the very least. But this is kind of like a coherent world that is informed by a type of rationality that may not jive with ours, but delivers its results, for example, in the forms of books just as well. Now, I should probably, I really haven't talk at all about what what I also what I wrote this book for, namely to make a statement, and I can elaborate on that in the question period, because I see I'm talking quite a bit.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Well, then I'll give it another 5 to 10 minutes, and tell you that one of the things that I want to argue in this particular project is that something that we can call Afro-Cuban religion, whatever its the problems with these predications are, as well as with the term religion itself, which I think, as in many parts of the world, practitioners of Afro-Cuban religion, or what we retrospectively think we can identify as such, really only belatedly began to understand that what they were doing was practicing a religion when they came into contact with regulatory or persecutory state agents. And this is actually exactly what happened, because by 1902, of course, the ratification of the Cuban Constitution under American auspices had included freedom of religion, which religious practice, as long as it didn't go against Christian morality. So in the midst of a really horrendous anti African witchcraft campaign driven by a number of self-appointed scientific modernizers who were sort of at that point highly infected with Lombrosian criminal anthropology. In the midst of campaigns against African witchcraft in Cuba, which were deadly, as a matter of fact. Lots of people wound up garroted or otherwise sort of killed. In the midst of that, a couple of practitioners decide to confront the issue head on and write themselves into the Cuban state apparatus as an African Christian Lukumi morality. And they acquired legal registration as a voluntary association and so on and so forth. And it really sort of began to mushroom out from there. I think they didn't really understand at that point that they were on the way to becoming a religion. But by the 1930s, 40s, they had understood that they could actually really inscribe themselves into the state, the legal apparatus of the state as such, and enjoy a certain amount of protection from a state that was otherwise persecuting them. What also falls into this period is a kind of an interesting volte-face on the part of one of those scientific modernizers, the great Fernando Ortiz, the towering intellectual Cuban, possibly Caribbean, and maybe even Latin American intellectual giant of the 20th century, who in probably the late teens or early 20s had a kind of a weird conversion experience and was suddenly no longer arguing that these things needed to be studied in order to be better eradicated, but was actually arguing that this is our heritage, and that Cuba was as he put it in a wonderful metaphor from which the title of my book derives, was a kind of a stew with different ingredients bubbling away on the hearth of history, so to speak. What he was arguing is that different kinds of ingredients in this kind of stew are still visibly demarcated as when you look on the surface, but as the cooking time increases, they sort of meld and blend into each other until you get something that is like a sauce on the bottom. And this was his vision for kind of a hybrid national, cultural, and in a sense racial project, which greatly inspired the revolutionary project after 1959, but Ortiz was very old by then. But anyway, Ortiz, by the 1920s, actually even before, and I found some stuff in his archive that indicates that he had been involved with practitioners of Afro-Cuban relations since about 1909, and had actually given them some legal advice about, you know, how to get permission, for example, to use African drums in public and things like that. But by the 1920s, he had actually amassed sizable Africanist literature, and he actually made that available to his informants. So starting a kind of a feedback process, which continued all through the 20th century, whereby practitioners read Africanist literature or read ethnographies about their predecessors, not uncritically. I mean, they oftentimes, will be the first to point out errors or, mistaken descriptions of things, but they kind of, also absorb stuff, partly also by using divination or by or spiritist, means in order to incorporate some of these things into their own practices. And so what begins to form at that point is what I call an ethnographic interface, where, and the interface is like a membrane, things pass back and forth across it, and sort of there's forms of inscription emerging on the ethnographic side that feed back into the practices that get inscribed subsequently, and all of this is kind of including, of course, the participants in this kind of, sort of unequal, to be sure, but certainly dialogic pattern, including the, the participants, are being, in a sense, cooked by history, so to speak. And what emerges is a constantly changing ethnographic object, so that is something where, practitioners objectify their practices just as we objectify them. And these two types of, there's an interactivity between these two forms or camps of forms of objectifying and camps of objectifiers. So there's a kind of, a sort of a circulatory pattern. And it becomes very interesting as you sort of look at this over over enough time when you take into consideration that some people on my side of the ethnographic interface have sort of crossed over and have now become objectifiers and practitioners of the of the matter of this object we all of us are calling Afro-Cuban religion. And on the other hand, there's people like Willie Ramos who's now becoming, academically certified historian of his own tradition, and which he continues to practice, and which also informs his scholarship in ways that I find utterly fascinating. Because one chapter which I in the book which I've called Astronauts of the Virtual Atlantic, the Giant African Snail Incident, the War of Curiapes and the Plague of Orishas, is actually based on a very learned and, in a sense, legally informed debate that Ramos, a couple of years ago, had on the web with a detractor from a faction of, African traditionalists, so to speak, or self-appointed African traditionalists, who resent certain practices that the, they think largely white Cubans are engaging in, and try to sort of reverse to what they think is an even more African pattern. But these, their projects get galore on that kind of time, including Cuba itself, sort of re-Africanization movements and stuff like that. But anyway, so they have this conversation, and as it turns out, one of the bones of contention is that Ramos has been laterally assimilating orishas, that is deities, which he received in Brazil. And so he's been doing research in Brazil on orishas that they and we think have been lost in Cuba, and he just brings them back, and they begin to proliferate. But it's not only that, so that there's what emerged on the web in particular. Is a kind of a pattern whereby entities, divine or other, begin to multiply in potentially uncontrollable fashion. And this is something that, you know, some people, particularly in Miami, are very, very worried about. I mean, when I was, I must have been sort of 6 or 8 years ago, and you know, I remember, you know, a moment when I haven't been in Cuba for about 2 years, and friends of mine, you know, picked me up at the airport, and you know, we chat a little bit about what's been going on, and they say, you know, and have you heard about this, you know, new entity, Miami Ochoronga? And I said, oh, what's that supposed to be? You know, it sounded kind of familiar in some ways, but they say, oh, it's, you know, this kind of being that this Babalao starts, you know, multiplying. You know, it's like almost like a, you know, laboratory for deities. And it's the spirit of evil doing. And, you know, so I thought, well, that sounds really weird. So, and, you know, and they were of the same opinion that, you know, sort of this is totally illegitimate, it's an invention, and, you know, why should one have that to begin with? You know, why a spirit of evil doing? So, you know, I thought, you know, where does that come from? And it hit me that it came from nowhere else but an article that Pierre Berger had written in the mid-1960s on the cult of, I always am reticent of pronouncing the Yoruba names because I'm making hash of it, you know, Iami Oshoronga or something like that, which was a cult, you know, still practiced in Yoruba land in the 1960s, the aim of which was to appease the, and that's a euphemism, the mothers, which basically the witches. And so, you know, so somebody had read that and thought, that's an interesting thing. We should have that too, you know. So there's that. And but anyway, I should, you know, I'm sure I can come up with, you know, other examples. As we engage in less one-sided conversation, and so I'm, you know, welcome. Any question? I should say that I need to split out here a couple of minutes before 2, because, you know, we're interviewing.
We'll be done.
Yeah. we're interviewing staff over at 9. Because, you know, you really have to look at where this happens. I mean, and I think it's useful to actually distinguish between, first of all, what the Argentine sociologist Alejandro Figerio calls primary and secondary diasporas. Primary being, for example, in the case of Cuba, Havana. Secondary diasporas being, for example, Miami, but also in the sense Santiago de Cuba, which, you know, where these Yoruba-derived Afro-Cuban religions only emerged in the 1930s through, you know, through a migration from the western part of the island. But anyway, then one could probably talk about tertiary diasporas, such as, you know, kind of satellite groups. You know, for example, here in Chicago, who are in some ways or other ritually dependent on, you know, ritual specialists in Miami, and the good ADD, Mr. Ramos, does a lot of work like that here in Chicago, so he comes through every once in a while and does some ritual work for people here. Now, New Ageification, in that sense, works best the further removed you are from a kind of an orthodoxy. That is, you know, kind of a group of people who try to monopolize, while arguing amongst themselves, correct ways of practicing it. You know, so, you know, Havana is no question. I mean, there is such an orthodoxy, and in Miami too. New York, I imagine, just as well. But as you move away from that, you know, things get a little different. You know, here, for example, you know, Afro-Cuban stuff merges quite, you just have to go to some of the botanicas, merges with Mexican, you know, folk practices. And, you know, that's, you know, something that, you know, people, I don't know if they care about, but it's, you know, we're the boondocks from the perspective of, you know, the Afro-Cuban primary or secondary diasporas. So here, sure, I mean, you know, if you want it, you can mess around, you can sort of enhance. I mean, on the web, so, you know, so the kind of virtual diaspora is, I think, a wonderful site for exploring these kinds of merges with New Age sensibilities. But, you know, I remember, you know, I lived in Washington, D.C. For some 6 years in the 1990s through early 2000s, and one of the people, you know, I was talking about when I mentioned that, you know, 4 out of 5 people who started studying this stuff in the 1980s are now priests of, you know, an African religion. One of those people, a man named Michael Mason, who's a curator at the Smithsonian, also happens to be a practicing priest, and he had a little, you know, Casa de Santo, consisting largely of white American, and, you know, lots of them were women. So it's a, you know, kind of a, and many of them came from a New Age background. Some of them lived in Tacoma Park, which is sort of the, you know, the epicenter of, you know, New Ageism in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I remember being invited to a Lukumi marriage ceremony that our mutual friend Ernesto Pichardo had just invented a few years earlier. Which didn't involve any animal sacrifice, you know, so the pigeons were just let loose into the air and were, you know, all very civilized. But anyway, sort of, it was really interesting to sort of observe, you know, these, you know, American adherents, devotees, don't know what to call them, talk about the various problems that they perceive. Animal sacrifice being really big, you know, that's just very, very hard to stomach for most New Ages. Unless, you know, maybe if they came from a Wiccan, you know, background, it would might be a different story, but, you know, I don't know enough about it. But and there are, by the way, there are merges on online. You can see merges between Wiccan sensibilities and Afro-Cuban religions. I mean, very interesting, all of that. But you know, so animal sacrifice was a real big thing. Possession trance. Lots of people just, you know, how in the world would I ever get possessed? You know, and what would happen if I did? You know, and, you know, some of them may have tried, actually, but didn't work. So that's another issue. But so there are, you know, there are these things occurring here. But interestingly, what's happening in Havana, and that's been happening for a long time, you know, and in the other parts of the Caribbean, is, of course, the spread of Western esotericism, or now also Eastern esotericism, which gets layered onto things, you know, so that, for example, good friend of mine, a really interesting story, you know, didn't make it into the book, but you know, I need to write that up sometime at a later stage. A good friend of mine, who was actually the first Cuban sent to the Soviet Union to study anthropology, he got a master's from the University of Leningrad, and was then sent on all kinds of, you know, sort of really horrible, you know, sort of missions in Angola and in eastern Cuba, where, you know, sort of villages were to be flooded, you know, or hydroelectric dams, and sort of kind of, you know, state-sponsored ethnographic projects, which to this day are classified. I mean, he has, you know, he had to surrender everything he had about that. But anyway, so he comes back. You know, has a bit of a career in the you know, Cuban Academy of Sciences, and then somehow falls out of political favor, gets fired from all of his positions, and basically retreats to his native town of Regla, where he eventually befriends a very old and impressive man, neighbor of his who's a practitioner of the Afro-Cuban religion, and eventually gets, you know, my friend gets initiated too. So, he has a large family. There's like six siblings. One of them, he's a santero. One of the siblings is a Reiki master. So another one is a lawyer. They cover all the bases. They do other kinds of, but each one of them does a different kind of practice, ranging from law to Western esoteric traditions, or in that case, Reiki, which is apparently spreading like crazy in Havana these days. But there are long traditions of consulting, things like, Egyptian Book of the Dead, just seeing, dabbling in these things to see whether there are correspondences. The idea of an Egyptian origin of Yoruba culture is old and has been spread around by the Brits, actually, during colonial times. And reached theological flourishes in the 1940s, and onward, actually, where along philological lines have been made to trace whatever the Yoruba did to Egypt. So it's not surprising that since people learned in Cuba by the 1930s that they were practicing a Yoruba-derived religion, because the Yoruba as such didn't really exist by the time that the slaves left Cuba. And the Yoruba identity is really a Christian missionary project that commences in about the 1890s and really only consolidates by about the 1920s or so. So there's an ethnogenetic process going on there as well. But, in the course of that, Egyptophilia plays a certain role. So, why not, once you know that, you're practicing something that comes out of Yoruba land and that in turn comes out of Egypt, why not assimilate towards that literature as well? So, that's been going on for a long time as well. And, one of the things, if you talk about the Anglophone Caribbean, for a long time, the center, if one wants to put it that way, of a kind of occult Afro-Caribbean world was 828 South Wabash Avenue, because that was the seat of the De Lawrence Company, which mail order, sent, occult literature. De Lawrence himself produced a fabulous array of crazy stuff, Hindu magic and whatnot, the sixth and seventh book of Moses, they sold that by the thousands, the Petit and Grand Albert, all of these grimoires, that kind of stuff. And they sold it all across the Anglophone colonial world. A friend of mine always comes up with the greatest research strategies, presented, I think it was at the American Academy of Religion meetings here in Chicago a few years ago, presented a paper on research that he had done online in philatelic sites, where people actually have a category, and I don't know if it's called imprint or whatever, of letters, stamped letters that were addressed to the De Lawrence Company and are being sold at relatively high prices. And by looking at where these letters came from, you suddenly got this kind of geography of a De Lawrence Empire, which reached all across the Anglophone Caribbean, where all of these books were prohibited. And actually, possession of these books could land you in jail, or at least in front of a magistrate for practicing obia. But it also, De Lawrence also reached into Africa. There are, there are letters mailed from the Belgian Congo, and all the way across to the Pacific, Mauritius and the Leone. So there are these, points of connection which, people have not really paid enough attention to, because these are really kind of, that's perhaps where I should say something about the misgivings in terms of religion here. The view of religions as kind of discrete, innumerable entities is really let's face it, a product of the breakup of, you know, Catholic Christendom in the course of the Reformation, and you know, then the kind of you know, religious, largely secularist religious history scholarship that comes out of the Enlightenment and the 19th century. So the idea that, for example, there are you know, religions, and then there are syncretic mixtures of them is totally alien to, I think, a lot of people who practice this, that, or the other thing. And it's really an artifact of, you know, scholarly and, you know, some, of course, also on the part of, you know, religious orthodoxies, endeavors to police boundaries around what, you know, you want to define as a religion. So, in, I mean, you know, there's an essay in here which I use, you know, revised, a chapter in here which is revised version of an essay that I published in 1993, where you know, sort of I basically say that, you know, syncretism is really an artifact that you know, we have brought into the world, but that in a sense we have lost control over, because, you know, some people actually like to define themselves as syncretic in the sense of being ecumenical, you know, so that, you know, we're open to everything. So that's, you know, fine, you know, which is also in part a kind of a New Age, you know. I mean, some versions of New Age have that kind of, you know, omnivorous quality.
I think we're really just out of time.
Oh, okay.
We thank you for listening to or viewing our podcast. For more information and for other podcasts, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts. Copyright, the University of Chicago Divinity School.